Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. Joining me today is Walter Bosley, the author of a series of amazing books, Empire of the Wheel, then Empire of the Wheel 2 and 3, on many topics, but one of them being the airship mystery. Walter gave an excellent presentation at Secret Space Program 2015, which is in fact our recommended movie of the week, and it was titled The Airship's Mystery and the Origins of the Breakaway Civilization. There's several reasons why I want to be talking about The Airship's Mystery, and by far and away, Walter's was the best presentation I've ever seen on this subject. So, Walter, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Soleri Report. Is that a noise in the background? What is that?
That is going to disappear immediately because that's my dog, and I'm going into another room. He will not be joining. I apologize. He was given.
No, he sounds like a great dog.
He's a wonderful little guy, but he usually lays real still under his blankie, but he got a new toy today, so about an hour ago, so it's still fresh to him. But I'm good back here now.
Okay. So let me just, by way of introduction, Walter has a very significant history in intelligence enforcement, which absolutely helps inform some of the topics he's describing, because he's describing many different crimes in California throughout the Empire of the Wheel. So, Walter, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Well, thank you for having me, Catherine. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
So one of the things we're going to start with is San Bernardino and the San Bernardino Working, which you introduce in the first book, Empire of the Wheel, and describe it as an investigation of occult espionage and murder. But how did you first get interested in San Bernardino?
I have spent much of my life here. My father, when he was in the Air Force in the late 50s, that brought him from West Virginia to California, specifically to the Victorville area, where he was stationed at George Air Force Base. And he liked Southern California so much that subsequently, when he met my mom, who's from Alabama, they both liked California so much, they decided when they got married, they'd stay out here, and they settled in the San Bernardino Valley. Interestingly, though, I was born in San Diego, because for a while, after the Air Force, he was working for another place. My sisters were born here. They were born right here in a place called Loma Linda. And throughout my life, for elementary, most of elementary school and junior high and high school, I lived in the San Bernardino Valley and went to junior college here. And even though when I went to work for the government, that took me all over the place, the San Francisco Bay Area, New York, wherever, Ohio, all over the world, I still, returned here. I have, family here and such. So
it's home.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was because you were there that you picked up on our first topic, which is the San Bernardino Working in 1915. So tell us about the San Bernardino Working and why initially you picked up on it.
Well, when you live in this area for a substantial period of time, particularly during the era that I grew up in, the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s, you hear the stories of not only haunted houses. Redlands is considered, this is kind of a fun fact, Redlands is considered one of the most haunted towns in the United States because there's so many ghosts and things like that. So there's that kind of theme. But on the darker side, you hear the stories of cult, very dark occult activity of cults, even satanic worship, that kind of thing. It's kind of part of the lore of this valley. So with that in the background, I had done a book on the what I consider to be the esoteric engineering of Disneyland, which is a interesting book in itself. And as a result of that book, I was following up on the research associated with it, and I was looking for weird little stories of strange phenomena, that were associated with telluric current, which are mistakenly called, even by me sometimes, ley lines, but basically this this idea of the world energy grid.
And when we say energy grid, you mean natural energy grid.
Yes, natural telluric current, the extreme low frequency ELF that runs through the terrain. And technicians in telegraphy since the days of railroad and then radio after that have tapped into this energy, of course. Well, the basic premise of the Disneyland book is that there's an intersection of three of these energy lines in Disneyland. Now, of course, they arc out. They simply intersect at Disneyland. But of course, they spread out and run through Southern California. And two of them run out this way by the San Bernardino Valley. So I was following up, wondering if there were strange, weird stories right here in San Bernardino associated with where I thought these lines ran through. Okay. So it started as just kind of a fun follow-up on an interesting esoteric, I dare say paranormal, fun topic associated with my Disneyland book. But it ended up being something else because as I was looking into this information, I had been, through other means and other research, finding weird little things about symbology associated with an ancient goddess and all that in nearby Riverside. Riverside and San Bernardino are kind of a sister city kind of situation here in this area. So when I was following up on the Disneyland research, I found a story of a haunting of our local mall. And I met with the woman, a lady named Antoth. My gosh, I'm doing a brain dump on her name. I apologize, Ann. Anyway, I met with her and she told me about this woman who she thought was haunting the mall here in San Bernardino, the Inland Center Mall. And that woman was named Cora Stanton and she had allegedly committed suicide. Well, Ann felt that this woman, Cora Stanton, had actually been murdered. So I went and followed her lead and I looked into the old newspapers dating back to 1915. And the bottom line is on it, I realized, wait a minute, there's six other very mysterious, questionable deaths. Three of them had to be murders, clearly, right, that happened around the time that this mystery woman, Cora Stanton, had allegedly committed suicide. And that was the day that, you know, when I was looking at all that I realized, oh, there's something really strange going on here with this. And it just exploded from there the more I looked at it.
And so it was between August 2015 and November 2015. 1915, right. You have six very strange deaths in San Bernardino. You know, if you go through the statistics of the period, and statistically this is so far outside the norm, it's hard to believe.
Exactly.
Right.
It's very questionable. And coming from the perspective of a, you know, former federal criminal investigator and, of course, a licensed PI, by this time, it immediately raised flags for me. You know, hey, there's something going on here. And then I began to pull threads and there were thematic connections, actual thematic connections. There were synchronicities of method, you might say, like, you know, four of the victims were poisoned, including the mystery woman and all that. You've read the book. And just the more threads I pulled, the more obvious to me and stranger that it actually got.
Now, here's what's interesting. So San Bernardino at the time is a hotbed of various kinds of economic opportunity. And it's also a hotbed of intelligence. There's pretty significant presence of intelligence agencies there.
That was something that was really going on in the whole state of California at that time, obviously because of the war. What's interesting is, even with my professional history in what I did with counterintelligence, what's interesting is I had never heard of this activity between the German agents and the agents of India that was going on here in the whole state of California. And it was very enlightening, very eye-opening.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I knew about the British and the Germans, which you talk about, but the Indians were new news to me. That was a new one. I was like, oh, did they come in through the Brits or what?
Well, and the reason is obvious, right? The Germans were smuggling guns to them, to the Indian agents, so that they could keep England busy on two fronts, right? Pretty obvious, right. but I just, like you, I didn't know this until I was digging into this mystery and looking at the background of, you know, hey, what exactly is going on at the time?
So,
and what brought it all to San Bernardino was the fact that it was a major railroad hub.
Right. Right. And we know that the society is always organized around the railroads.
Mm-hmm.
So now I get to tell you my San Bernardino story. I served as Assistant Secretary of Housing, and then several years later, my company won a competitive bid to be the lead financial advisor and portfolio strategist to the FHA. And at the time, they had about a $500 billion mortgage insurance portfolio. So we started to break it down. We wanted to look at it by county. So the guy I had working on it comes to me and says, "You're not going to believe it." He said, "Do you know what the number one location for mortgage defaults and fraud is in America per capita? The highest per capita by like a multiple of 10. I said, "No, where?" He said, "San Bernardino, California."
Oh, boy.
So, you know, it was off the charts. Now, here's the thing. One of the things I quickly discovered when I was assistant secretary is there are all sorts of rules that suddenly get thrown out the window when there's a disaster. And there was a pattern in the places that had high mortgage fraud, but San Bernardino was certainly one of them, where they would have these mysterious fires, and then suddenly everything would get written off. And so it was one of the reasons I always had it in my mind I would never live in San Bernardino, because you could get burnt down while they're cleaning up the mortgage fraud. Anyway,
exactly.
So we stopped working on the contract, I think, in 1997. And then I'm out, I don't know, about 6 months later at this huge, very fashionable brunch. It was sort of cocktail party brunch out in Langley, Virginia, right next to the agency. And I'm seated at a table next to a woman who's the chief of staff to the chairman of Freddie Mac. And she turns to me and she says, "You're not going to believe it. We have the strangest thing. I've been doing special projects on the portfolio. We have this incredible, unprecedented, unbelievable amount of defaults in this place. You'll never guess where it is." I said, "Oh, I know exactly where it is. It's in San Bernardino." And she looked at me. She almost dropped her Bloody Mary and she said, "Oh, how did you know?" And then there was someone there from Fannie Mae. And what we discovered was if you took the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA defaults, it looked to me just wild ass guessing that, you know, the defaults in San Bernardino were many multiples of the homes there. Now, it's not surprising that right at that time, the congressman who had San Bernardino in his district got made the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee.
Okay.
In Congress. So whatever was going on there, it was definitely working for the military-industrial complex, but it's not over yet. So then, for reasons which I won't describe right now, I came to the conclusion that there was something that super domestic intelligence operations were being funded out of the newly created asset forfeiture fund in a Department of Justice. You know, they're doing all these seizures in connection with enforcement. And lo and behold, what I discover is the hotbed for the country of all these seizures is out of course, the LA office where we have massive defaults. But that attorney general's office is run, can you guess? The Central District of California from San Bernardino.
Why is this not surprising me?
And what we used to say is, what's going on in San Bernardino?
Exactly.
So, but you got the feeling that whatever you were dealing with was very, very old and deep. And so when I started to read your books, I would periodically stop and just laugh and laugh and laugh because, you know, it's... I only know what I touched, but it was clearly, you know, this was very old and deep. And to get to these levels of fraud, you would had to have built networks over long periods of time that were very ingrained. So what you call the Inland Empire, you know, this was clearly an engineering of the Inland Empire, and they were pulling a lot of money out of there.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, we used to have Norton Air Force Base, and it closed, I believe, if I'm recalling right, in the early 90s, maybe the late 80s, but I think it was the early 90s. And it became this thing called the San Bernardino International Airport, which it's not, it is able to function as such. They even have a terminal and everything, but it's mostly used to service fleets of aircraft. Now, it's my opinion that knowing how the DOD and the Air Force operates, it's my opinion that I think the Air Force / DOD probably still has a presence there so mm-hmm. that they could activate that base whenever they want to. Now, what's interesting is
they probably needed to fly all the cash around.
Well, yeah. Did you know that this former Norton Air Force Base, now San Bernardino National Airport, is the only place in Southern California that no matter what the weather is like everywhere else, it's usually the place that they bring Air Force One because they can count on being able to land here.
Wow.
Which is interesting. Now, another interesting thing about it, this base, and I believe this ties in exactly to what you're talking about as far as what's going on here and what's being channeled through here, is that we have had, things in the strange UFO world associated with Norton Air Force Base. Now, why does that factor into our conversation? Is because if you set aside the legend of the whole ET mystery and you look at these things from the perspective that you and I and our friend Joseph Farrell look at it, where it's probably actually secret space program technology we're talking about, okay? I just learned a couple of years ago when writing my book Shimmering Light that allegedly something associated with the whole Roswell legend was once housed here at Norton Air Force Base.
So let me jump to the Sonora Aero Club, because one of the things yes. that you start, you pull the string in mm-hmm. Empire of the Wheel, and then you follow it in Empire of the Wheel too, is mm-hmm. what many Americans, we were all brought up on this theory that the Wright mm-hmm. brothers started Flight in America, which, of course, when you look at the facts, is the most ridiculous thing you can imagine. And in fact, there were airships of some kind flying around this country for quite, many decades sure. before then. But one of the most famous examples is the Sonora Air Club. So why don't you just introduce us to the airship's mystery and the Sonora Air Club?
Yes, I, like a lot of people interested in the whole thing, I had heard of the 1890s airship mystery. That's the one that's actually better known. And it was interesting through the story that my father had told me for years that involved this shadowy figure named Wilson. I had learned that there were Wilsons associated with the airship mystery. Now, I had never heard of Charles Delshow or the Sonora Aero Club until probably the mid-2000s, about 2004, 2005, when I had read a book by Theo Pymans about John Worrell Keeley, in which he talks a little bit about Delshow and the mysterious NIMSA in there. And then talking with Greg Bishop, when I was first getting to know him, I heard a little bit more about Delshow and the Sonora Aero Club. So when I looked at it more closely, I discovered that there was a Wilson involved in the Sonora Aero Club. So that's what led me into a real interest in it. And then I read the stuff by Crenshaw and Busby and all them. But in a nutshell, what you have is a German immigrant named Charles Delshow came to the United States through Texas. And he claimed to have been sent by this German organization that sponsored these various groups that were dabbling in interesting and advanced for the day technology. And the only group that he specifies in his journals and in his art books is this Sonora Aero Club based in Sonora, California, which is just on the western side of Yosemite, okay, in Tuolumne County. Now, the Sonora Aero Club themselves were a group of German immigrants. And you begin to see a theme here in this. These German immigrants who came to the United States, and according to Delshow, they were dabbling with what appeared to be chemically induced anti-gravity lift, for lack of a better explanation. And they built these little flying contraptions that they called Aeros, spelled A-E-R-O. Now, Charles Delshow, he claimed, of course, that this was going on in the 1850s, the decade before the American Civil War, when flight back then was just merely balloons. Okay.
Right.
Now, Delschau in the 1880s, I believe it was 1880s, 1890s, started creating these just numerous volumes of art where he would do these schematics of these flying machines that he claimed to have witnessed these guys flying or trying to develop in California in the 1850s. And between the late 1880s and 1923, when he died, Delschau produced several of these illustrations, hundreds of them, and also put together he took his journals from the day, and I believe he translated part of them. So he dies in 1923 in Houston, and these things are just sitting in an attic until they're thrown out, and a junk man finds them in 1970.
Right, and they're quite beautiful. They're quite beautiful and fascinating looking.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
yeah.
It's indeed fascinating. And basically, we would not have known about Charles Delschau if a man named Fred Washington found all these drawings, these books, these volumes in the journal in the trash. And he took them to his junk and antique collectible shop. And Pete Navarro was looking at them there and became fascinated and started really investigating who was this Delschau, who was the Sonora Aero Club. And for a few years, he collected as many of the illustrations as he could afford. But what was interesting in the end of that part of the story is that several of these illustrations ended up, of all places, in the Manil collection of John D. Manil, the gentleman, he and his wife, who turn up in the JFK assassination milieu
right.
via an association with Permindex and the World Trademark.
So one thing to understand about the airships is we mm-hmm. have over 1,000 reports. Someone, I forget mm-hmm. if it's the fellow who wrote the lead book on airship mysteries, but one of them went back and went and, you know, got into the microfiche and looked at old papers all across the country. And there mm-hmm. are over 1,000 reports of airships mm-hmm. landing and people getting out and saying they're from New York and, you know, and talking to people and then getting back in and leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, this is widely, widely documented. This is not, you know, just a few sightings. This is a massive collection of sightings during this period.
Yes. When people give an honest look at this, an honest look, they find that this was not just a little collection of stories over the course of the week of April Fool's Day in 1897. This, as you said, there were just numerous reports all across the, you know, mostly west of the Mississippi River and, you know, from Canada down to Mexico, that kind of thing. And absolutely, they would, in many cases, they would land and very human pilots and crewmen would come off the thing and talk with the witnesses and tell them they were going to South America and all that. So this was very much a human endeavor of its time. It was not, you know, anything to do with what people assumed in recent times, what it was about.
Right. I mean, the only aliens that were landing, well, it appears that most of the aliens landing were from Wall Street or someplace like that. Now, let's talk a little bit about NIMSA, because one of the things that comes up again and again and again in the airship's mystery is how many of these people are either German immigrants, or their technology traces back to Germany. So we mm-hmm. have a very Germanic lineage here. And so maybe if you could talk about NIMSA.
Yeah, NIMSA. NIMSA is a word. It's an acronym. It's all capital letters that we can trace back to its first mention in the works of Charles Delschau, who we were talking about a moment ago. And this is the organization that Delschau claimed was headquartered in Germany. Okay. A lot of people thought that because of what you're referring to, the people in New York that were associated with the airship mystery, a lot of people assumed that because NIMSA is spelled NYMZA, that it was a New York-based organization, obviously because of the NY. But Delschau himself tells us that it was definitely a German-based organization. And when you go back to the 1850s, you're talking about, you know, the really a Prussian movement prior to unification. Now, if I had to come up with a mission statement for this organization, I would state it as NIMSA is a distinctly Prussian a distinctly Prussian nationalist organization dedicated to a unified Germany's global superiority in active pursuit of influence and exploitation of the natural resources and industry of the Americas. Now, I know that's a big mouthful, but if you unpack that, what you have is the source of this Germanic thread, okay, and what they were all about. We know that the Prussian movement was behind unification of Germany and building a unified Germany's strength in Europe, and of course, its influence throughout the world. And that's all included in that mission statement, which I crafted based on the known Prussian history at the time and the things Delschau was talking about in his works. So it looks like NIMSA was clearly an apparatus of this Prussian movement towards a unified Germany, a Second Reich.
Right. So what we're watching is literally, you know, you describe it as the origins of the break of the waste civilization, but what we're watching is literally people getting together, accessing advanced technology, and moving very significantly out of the mainstream.
Oh, absolutely. Through a military industrial complex, right?
Because right.
These were, you know, these would have been industrialists who would have made this happen. So
right.
There we have the model of our, what we call our military industrial complex, which is really the very origin of the concept of the breakaway civilization, as you point out.
One of my favorite quotes, let me see if I can find it. I think it was in Empire II, is how basically your comparison of the Sonora Air Club with the NIMSA, basically people who want to do their own thing versus people who want to control what other things people can do. Oh, here it is.
Yes.
In the secret airship factions, you have what appears to be a conflict between those who simply want to do their own thing and those whose thing is to dictate what everyone else's thing should be.
That's our major conflict today in the world, I think. You know, you got the people that want to be left alone and the people who don't want to leave everybody else alone. And there they clash.
Right.
And it was back then, too.
Now, we've spent a lot of time on the Solaire Report talking with Joseph about sort of how the Nazis got financed out of the Anglo-American alliance and then after the war, you know, sort of integrated back in. Mm-hmm. So I think most Solaire Report subscribers understand that the Nazi threat is one that is much longer lived, you know, mm-hmm. before and after. But there's some very interesting information about the Nazis in, as you go through both 2 and 3. But clearly what you see is the, you know, the airships, the Germans and the airships was continuing before the Third Reich and after the Third mm-hmm. Reich. You know, this is something that integrated back into the military-industrial complex here mm-hmm. and continues to be ongoing.
Yes. What's interesting is we don't really know. We get little stirrings through the old writings of the theosophy culture community, you know, connected with the spiritualists and all that.
Right.
In the 1890s, we see NIMSA bandied about there. But in
right.
my opinion, the 1890s airship mystery itself was interestingly not, in my opinion, a NIMSA endeavor. It was the result of the similar technology being developed by an American group. And I think, of course, what it was a post-Civil War black project, in my opinion, America's
right.
first black project, all because of the whole Solomon Andrews thing, pitching his flying machine. So we don't know exactly what NIMSA, the Prussian-German Second Reich NIMSA, would have been doing in the 1890s, but my best guess is they were involved in finding gold, resources of gold in South America, because they had gone on the gold standard at that time. And naturally, they would have continued developing this threat of technology. And during this period where they were looking for the sources of gold, this obviously would have given them a much greater budget to work with. So naturally, we can assume that they were advancing things along. And the first evidence we see of this idea would be in the development of De Glocke, the legendary bell, and the things that the Nazis were beginning to do in the World War II period.
One of the things which I thought was very interesting is, you know, because if you go back throughout history, flight has been with this planet one way or another if you just look at the drawings. But if you look at the history of the Indian cultures having flying ships, I thought it was very interesting that you pointed out that the Nazis and the Germans had gone out to Asia and come back with secret technology, whatever that was. But the question was it the, you know, the technology related to the flying machines they had many centuries ago?
I think it was. And I think that it wasn't so much the Ananervi and the other, you know, German archaeologists and what they necessarily discovered, you know, through the 1920s and on towards the war. I think a great deal of what we're talking about was provided to them by whatever the NIMSA had become by the Nazi era. Because from my perspective, the NIMSA is behind the development and rise of the Nazis. Okay. So if you're looking at, we have the Delschau material dating the slang with this flying technology, anti-gravity stuff, dating back to the 1850s. And as you know, I show the thread from the 1850s into the 20th century, you know, to the Nazis. To me, in my mind, in my analysis, it's obvious that they inherited this information, this ancient information, this old information from this NIMSA organization, and certainly enhanced it with the modern technology, particularly, you know, adding the electricity and the electromagnetism aspect to the bell.
So one of the clear aspects of the airship mystery and the things going on around it is wherever you turn, you find the intelligence services. So you find Pinkerton, you find the U.S. Secret Service, you find British intelligence, you find German intelligence. And you know, sometimes I used to think, who is it that's not networked by these guys? They network everything.
Exactly.
And I thought you did a very clever job of sort of weaving in and out and trying to figure out what the connections are. It's always ultimately impossible. But I've always said that investment never goes where enforcement isn't available to perform. And in fact, you know, if you look at all the railroad investment, all the investment in California, Pinkerton was always there to make sure, you know, the enforcement worked. Because the industrialists of those days didn't depend on the government. They depended on private guys.
Right.
And that was Pinkerton. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. And it's interesting, if you'll recall, in the Empire of the Wheel research, we have Police Chief Walter Shea, who he and his officers, investigators, are trying to figure out, you know, what's going on in 1915 in San Bernardino. Well, what's interesting is, as I mentioned before, San Bernardino was then and still is to some degree. It certainly has been most of my life, a major railroad hub. Okay.
Right.
Walter Shea, during his law enforcement career, worked as a railroad investigator. So this is a guy who, you know, here we have the railroad. Here we have a guy who was in this enforcement involved with the railroad. And so you have to wonder from his perspective, because he was very close to Vest. There's nothing in the existing material that really expresses his personal opinion on anything. So you have to wonder, coming from the perspective of having worked within that railroad milieu, what he thought of what was going on with all these agents, you know, these intelligence activities that were, you know, present throughout California, because of exactly what you said. I mean, there's the railroad, you know, smack dab in the heart of all this, you know, this place where this weird stuff is going on. Exactly.
Well, another theme that comes up, you've already mentioned it, is the telluric energy and its relationship mm-hmm. to gold. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about its relationship to gold.
Well, that's something that my colleague, the author, Seshari, who has since retired from all of this, he did an excellent analysis of the role of the telluric current and geomorphology, how it plays with geomorphology in the physical natural creation or production of gold. Mm-hmm. He argued that people who understood geomorphology, and particularly this telluric current, could actually find where gold is produced in the earth. And it's his theory, it's Harry's theory, that the 1849 gold rush was a staged event. The whole thing about Sutter's Mill and all that, he uh-huh. argues that it was a staged event, that the railroad people and the equivalent of the shadow intelligence world at the time, you know, that these mm-hmm. people were talking about that would have been in the know, that they already knew that gold was there. They knew how to find it. And the discovery of it was staged, much like it is said that Columbus's discovery of the New World was a staged event to just reveal that what they already knew, that the New World was there, the Americas.
Right. Well, part of it is, it's like Bitcoin. You want to get everybody working and figuring out what you need.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And what's interesting is Harry points to these mountain formations in the terrain called Hodges, and that it is around a hodge. It's usually like a round mountain, which is kind of a pointy top, which somewhere around the base of that mountain, you can find the telltale natural signs. That's where gold is being made by the earth. And he went into this whole thing about even place names called Hodge were little identifiers that were slapped onto these places. It's interesting. And it's interesting that, of course, you know, the railroad people
clearly,
you know,
knew.
Dealt with geomorphology.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, they had to, especially the telegraph lines. So
yes.
Another theme that comes up in your work and comes up again in Empire of the Wheel is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which we all know
yeah.
from Paul Newman and Robert Redford's movie, but in fact were mm-hmm. very famous outlaws. As we know, the line between intelligence agencies and outlaws is usually very muddled.
mm-hmm. Yes.
And so it is here. So tell us a little bit about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and how they fit in with the Sonora Air Club and this whole scene.
Right. Well, and I'm going to assume that most of the audience is familiar with them, basically, either from
yeah.
the movie or reading about them. So here we have these outlaws who operated coincidentally in the area where the great airship mystery sightings were going on. And in the time.
And I should just mention, because you go through this, the geography of it very carefully. You know, these are not all in a small place. You know, it's in
yeah.
Montana, it's in Wyoming, it's all the way down
yeah.
to the border.
Utah. Exactly.
Yeah, but where the airships are showing up, they're showing up too. It's
yes.
quite remarkable.
So,
right.
It's a real curious thing. Now, in a nutshell, what I dug into and found is that at one point, Butch was tired of being a criminal. He was just tired of it. So he went to the governor of Utah and said, you know, I want amnesty. And the governor told him, well, I can't give it to you. The way this works is you got to go to the guy you've been robbing and make a deal with him, and he can give you amnesty. And that happened to be Mr. E.H. Harriman of the Union Pacific Railroad, the CEO. And it turns out, we find out that E.H. Harriman, the money he borrowed to build his Union Pacific Railroad, to bring it all together and make it happen, was from Kuhn Loeb, okay, two German-born bankers in the United States who, at that time, at one time, owned almost 70% of all the physical railway in the United States. Think about
it. Right,
that.
Although if they owned it, they would have been an agent for the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers or something.
There you go, yeah.
Right.
A front for something, which in turn, which also I associate them with this mysterious NIMSA group. Now, in a nutshell, basically, what I think happened, we are told that Butch decided to never meet with E.H. Harriman, and nothing came of it, okay? And I argue otherwise.
Now, your theory about Pinkerton brokering a deal makes much more sense.
Yeah, I think the deal was brokered between Butch and Harriman. I think Butch agreed to take the deal that ended up getting all the other members of the Hole in the Wall gang, except Sundance and Etta, caught or killed. Here's what's interesting. This was a gang that could never be caught. They were just so good. Now, after this period that Butch approaches the governor for amnesty and he's told to go to Harriman.
They're all getting caught.
Exactly. They're all getting caught. And what's interesting is increasingly Butch and Sundance are not going out on the robberies in which they're getting caught.
Right.
Right. So yeah,
what a coincidence.
Yeah. So it sounds like a setup. And this was what led me to look closer at Sundance and conclude that, in my opinion, Harry Longabaugh was recruited when he was at the Flying J or the Flying Bar Ranch or something like that. Flying Bar, I think. The Flying Bar Ranch in Canada. I think he was recruited at that time by the Northwest Mounted Police, which became the RCMP, because they were the major counterintelligence law enforcement agency of the day. I think he was recruited into law enforcement at that time. And then when he came into the United States, he then became an asset or an undercover agent of the Secret Service, which a lot of folks don't realize there was no FBI. If you were a Fed, you were Secret Service back then. And I think that Sundance was an undercover agent the whole time he was in the Hole in the Wall gang, which of course leads us to the big star of the show at a place. But I think the deal that Butch and Sundance and Etta, mainly Butch, took with E.H. Harriman involved them going to South America, which we know they did. And of course, as you know, I lay out how that was associated with, you know, the railroads and the Secret Service and Pinkertons and possibly NIMSA.
Right. And one of the things I thought was very good is you make perfectly clear, if you look at how they're sailing back and forth and back and forth, there's no way that can go on if they're really wanted. It's not happening. So there's another story here.
And there's also Frank DeMeo, the Pinkerton man who was the South America man who could never seem to be at the right place at the right time to catch Etta and Butch and Sundance down in South America, right? We find out that DeMeo, early in his career, was actually an undercover operative for the Secret Service, which, of course, was founded by Alan Pinkerton, right? The patriarch of the family. So here you have a long history of Pinkerton and Secret Service woven together. And, of course, as you know, you've read the book. My opinion is that Frank DeMeo, not only did he not catch Etta, Butch, and Sundance for the Pinkertons, I think he was actually working for Secret Service as a go-between. And he was never intended to catch them because, in my opinion, Sundance and Etta were both operatives for the Secret Service. So I think that's what was going on there.
Right. Well, they could have just been skimming their piece for the black budget then.
Who knows?
You'll see these corporations who allow, you know, shrinkage on their inventory, and it's all agreed with the mob, and it's part of some deal. And it's a system. Yeah. No, there's all sorts of stuff going on. We just did a great Salieri report on the Kennedy assassination. And the reason we kind of did a deep dive on who was involved is I'm trying to get everybody to understand that this was not a syndicate that came together for the purpose of killing Kennedy. This was a syndicate that was running narcotics operations in 3,100 counties, you know, for decades before, you know, they were already together.
Yeah.
And so the lines between organized crime or the mafia and the intelligence agencies, you know, was very murky. You know, I mean, the reality is that the highest profit businesses that makes the kings the most money are the ones with the highest margin, right?
Right.
And don't have to pay taxes. And that's been going on for quite some time. So, okay. So are you ready for my second really weird story?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm sitting at Secret Space Program, and I'm listening to your presentation very intently because I've always wanted to know more about the airship's mystery. And I'm listening intently, and suddenly you put up a picture of Butch Cassidy, and and you start describing him.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely froze. You know how hard it is to shock me, Walter? I was in a state of complete shock because Butch Cassidy is the spitting image. I mean, it's not look like he was, he is my brother.
Oh, wow.
Now, I haven't spoken to my brother in 13 years, and before then I barely spoke to him. You know, so I tried not to speak to him for many, many years. And then I finally, you know, in the world of politics, you can't talk to somebody, because if you refuse to talk to somebody, then if that person gets on a phone and says, oh, well, I talked to Fitz and she said the sky is green, and you have talked to him, then it might be true. And so it gets murky. So the only way you can stop that is to just refuse to talk to him. So, yeah. You know, this is somebody I don't trust and haven't talked to for, you know, years and years and years. And mm-hmm. You throw up this picture and it doesn't look like him. It is him. It is him.
Oh, wow.
And then you proceed to describe Butch Cassidy and it is him. I'm like,
that's
wait,
spooky.
Is this something connected to the special breeding club? What, you know, how is this happening?
Well, the interesting thing too, is we know that there's, you know, plenty of stories that Butch and Sundance were not killed in a shootout in South America, which I agree with that. Of course, I don't think they were killed in that shootout. Obviously, I think Harry Longabaugh showed up in the San Bernardino mystery, as you know.
Uh-huh.
So you have to ask yourself, have you looked closely at genealogy to see if there's any possible way that Cassidy...
Well, Butch Cassidy was a Mormon. And so I don't think, you know, that line of the family comes from the Steve Austin, Texas. And after some violence over there, they moved back to Tennessee. But that's Texas. It's not the Mormon. You know, the only thing that's completely weird here, and this is beyond over-the-top weird, but my mother was repeatedly told when my brother was born that he wasn't going to live. And then miraculously he lived. So,
but we have to remember that when Butch came back, he would have had to have assumed a different identity.
Right.
And who knows where he ended up and who he ended up with and whether he had children.
These are the little mysteries in life. I can't explain it. All I can tell you is when you put it up, I thought, is this a joke? Is this a trick? And, you know, the first thing I did was go search the internet and look and see, well, yeah, I guess that is. But that's one of the little mysteries of my life. Yeah. So I can't explain that.
Wow.
But there are people looking just like Butch wandering around helping the establishment now.
You have to wonder if he was fruitful and multiplied when he came back, and whose various families he ended up in.
I can't explain it. I can't explain it. Okay. One other thing, we talked about Del Shell's artwork, but his artwork has really come into, you know, it's now very, very popular and it's very beautiful.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to ask, because I'm going to see if we can use some of the pictures for our video on this interview, but I wanted to ask, how many of the sketches, do you think all of those are real machines?
Oh, he explains that some of them were real machines that they actually made and flew, and then others were the designs that they either didn't get to or they didn't have the resources
to build,
to put together.
So some are real and some are designs.
Yeah.
Now, just give us 2 seconds. How does Tesla fit into this?
Tesla is allegedly associated with this story in 1903 that some of the airship milieu came to him and asked him to build a craft that they could fly to Mars. It's this wild legend that involves Tesla. And peripherally, it was some of Tesla's ideas and some of the technology he was fooling with that, you know, was also reported associated with some of the airship mystery.
Now, one of the things you bring up, which I really liked, was you bring up Jacob Astor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm of the belief that the Titanic was not an accident. It was sabotage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we know Astor died, as did many of the other people with Astor who was opposed to the creation of the Federal Reserve, which was 1913.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you had this group who didn't want central control through a central bank, but were financing, Astor was financing Westinghouse and some of these, the scientists involved. Am I not correct?
Yes. And he also wrote some pretty interesting works of fiction that involved going to other planets.
Right. Right. It's quite remarkable when you look at everything that you've written about, Walter, just to imagine if for a second the people who wanted to be left alone to do their own thing had been allowed to.
Well, and I, of course, theorized that they did, because based on that legend of Tesla and the Marship and what you just specifically were saying about Astor,
right.
It's I have reason to suspect the possibility that some American group that involved Astor and these guys, like you said, that didn't want any part of the central banking, did not like the direction that the 20th century is taking, were would likely have been this mysterious group in 1903 that would have had the audacity to attempt a space flight with one of these airships. That's why I term them the 1903.
Right. So when you started talking about the railroad engineer, I realized, oh, John Galt does exist, and there is a John Galt Valley someplace, and that's what the breakaway civilization is, more or less.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
I really do think Ayn Rand was on to the same thing that I've been writing about.
Right. I think she was, too. I was waiting for you to suggest that, but I don't think you talked about it, did you?
No, not in the books, but it's an interesting, at least in my experience, and you know, our friend Dr. Farrow will agree, and I know you've experienced this, between what you publish, there are threads that, you know, you're pulling all sorts of threads, as you know, and not all of them make it into,
right.
You know, the book, right? And
right.
The Ayn Rand, John Galt, Atlas Shrugged whole thing is an interesting thread that has popped up in my research that no, I have not discussed in the works.
So here's why I think what you're doing is so, or one of the reasons I think it's so valuable. You know, when you explore these topics and you connect them to all the different dots we're connecting them to, it's like getting a can opener and opening your brain and saying, okay, now take this oversimplified, dumbed down version of history and let's just throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's something that's much richer, much more interesting, much more complex, and really pretty fascinating going on. That's got,
absolutely.
You know, it's, yeah. So, you know, it's got some serial killers, but it's got some great people too.
Yeah. The main thing, one of the main points too, is it helps you answer the question as to, well, why the other version, you know, why have we been and why are we still fed this other version? Case in point, when you're talking about the airship mystery and all these things we're talking about, gee, why does somebody keep pushing the gray ET, reverse engineer the Roswell crash, the German flying saucer thing? Why does someone, you know, seem to be pushing that? Well, it's because it very conveniently and easily covers these historical threads like I and others have been pulling. They don't want us to look at Charles Dalzell. They don't want us to look at NIMSA. They don't want us to look at the airship mystery.
Well, they don't want us to look close to home where our actions can have real change.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Okay, so if you were going to say, let's start with where you've left us with Empire of the Wheel and the Airship's Mystery, and we were going to develop that thread up through the Nazis and now the breakaway civilization and what's going on in the national security infrastructure, what would the bridge that would get us from where you've left us and take us into the breakaway civilization today? How do we follow the thread of the true story of flight from the Sonora Air Club through today?
Well, I think as you said, as laid out in the books I've done so far, we follow that thread. Basically, it runs through very human organizations and societies of the philosopher scientists who were looking at these, you know, ancient stories of flying machines, and they were adept with chemistry, they were adept with metallurgy, they were adept with all the emerging technologies that they needed, and they had the audacity to apply these ideas. Okay, and of course, when you look at this, you see that thread dating back in human history. It's there to see, and right. All leading up through both this German thread that we know, and the other thread, the American thread, and of course you had the French and the Italians fooling with flight and stuff too. But and the French is an interesting angle that comes up in my next book, which we'll talk about another time, I'm sure. But it leads to, as you said, World War II. Okay, right. Now how do we connect from World War II to today? I discovered that for me, it was ultimately very disturbing. I had started to do the research to do a book on this very thing, and I was turned on to one particular historical source that lays out in detail exactly how something was done, something that intellectually I was aware of and, you know, had heard of, but I had never seen the roadmap laid out like this particular book did. And what it in a nutshell convinced me was that Operation Paperclip was a planned institutional invasion of the United States by the Nazi structure. Okay, they knew that Germany was going to lose the war, and using a system that they had used for centuries, dating back to the old Junkers, who used the Teutonic Knights and then eventually destroyed them. They were the originators of the Prussian culture. And they did this through the centuries all the way up to the 20th century. They created the Nazi culture in Germany. They used Germany. And when they had used Germany and Germany was going to fall, they set their sights on the United States. And through Operation Paperclip, I'm convinced it literally was, I don't know if you'd use the word coup, but it was an invasion, a takeover.
And so I would say it this way. You had a leadership that you know, financed the Nazis, encouraged that whole thing, and then when they lost the war, you know, they continued to work with them and help them during the war, both sides. They were uh-huh. above both sides, and they were playing both sides together and helping both mm-hmm. sides. They then mm-hmm. took the cream of the technology and people and folded them into the United States.
But and yeah.
So I think.
But go ahead.
Sorry. I think they were, you know, you had a leadership layer, you know, above the thing the whole time. I don't know. Have you ever read Charles Higham's book, Training with the Enemies?
No.
So you'll see it very. I used to call it the metastructure when I talked to Joseph about it. And the metastructure was on both sides of that war and kept, you know, kept the Germans going a lot longer than they would
sure.
have lasted. And
oh, sure. That makes sense.
And then they folded a lot of the technology and stuff back in. And mm-hmm. it's all very managed. It's the only way I can describe it. It's all very managed.
Of course. Of course. And what I was getting at is that we think of Operation Paperclip as our idea and how it's like, hey, we're gonna incorporate what these German guys can do for us into our thing. No, what I discovered, what I realized is Operation Paperclip actually was probably not our idea. It was theirs. And
right.
they fully intended to transplant the idea of the model of the military industrial complex, which they had long been using as kind of an export system to invade and take over other countries from inside.
Right.
And I think that's exactly what they did the United States through our military industrial complex and all the nefarious things you see and you can point to between World War II and today that we think and see involves the military industrial complex.
Well, Walter, think about it. Do you think the title Department of Homeland Security is very subtle?
No, not at all. You know, it was really, I'll be honest with you, it was so disturbing to me when it actually came together and I realized, my gosh, this is exactly what they did. And it's a model they had been using for centuries, dating back to the days of the Fourth Crusade. Okay. And right. I realized they've done it to us. They did it to us. And this is why the United States has gone in the direction it went since World War II. I couldn't write the book anymore. I had to stop.
Well,
and work on something else.
It's very interesting. If you look at the threads, you see the Western, you know, sort of French, et cetera, Templars go through Scotland, come here mm-hmm. through the Scottish Enlightenment. Then you see the, mm-hmm. you know, the group that did the Third and Fourth Crusade in Germany, the Teutonic Knights, and mm-hmm. their thread then comes. And there's a giant compete and collaborate throughout history.
Right.
And they're philosophically, they're distinctly different threads, but there's no doubt that the German thread has always been masters at the technology, and that's been part of their
right.
their thing. And I suspect the cooperation and competition continues to this day. And we could talk about modern geopolitics, but I won't open that can of worms. So let's talk about how we follow Walter. Walk us through how we find your material online, how we get your books, and how we just stay current on what you're up to.
Well, as far as my books go, I am primarily only print on demand at lulu.com, lulu.com. And I do have I think two nonfiction books over at Amazon Kindle, but I've had bad luck with protecting the files on Kindle, so I don't do digital books anymore. But lulu.com is where you can find them, and they're a nicely done product, worth the wait. I am most active usually at the Walter Bosley channel at YouTube, where I discuss the things that I research and write about, and you know, things I try to keep it on that there. Also, I have the empireofthewheel.blogspot.com, which I haven't been active at so much lately because I've been busy working on this massive new book. But there are some very interesting essays related to the things we've talked about today, and of course the things I write about that you'll find there at empireofthewheel.blogspot.
Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that there's going to be a Secret Space Program 2019 this year. And
that's what
I'm hoping. Yeah, and I'm hoping that you and I will both participate, because
they have told me that they want me there. So if it happens,
they definitely. So, and that, of course, is where we're going to post your presentation from the last Secret Space Program conference up with this audio. And it's a great, you know, it's just a great introduction. If you want to get an introduction to this whole phenomenon, I think that's by far and away the best way to do it. And I hope Butch Cassidy doesn't look like your brother. you can watch it.
Yeah, fortunately, I don't have a brother, so I'm not worried about Butch showing up.
Anyway,
I would like to throw into that Empire of the Wheel. Those three books, of course, I sold the rights to a TV producer, and it's been in development. And pretty soon, I should know if it's going to be a TV series. I should know soon, so maybe I'll have some good news on that.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Are they going to film it in San Bernardino? I'd be a little nervous about that.
Yeah, I know. You got to wonder. They might just want to find somewhere else, but it should be a lot of fun if they make this thing happen.
Yeah, no, it will be a lot of fun. Okay, well, Walter, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for everything you're doing. If we can be of any assistance to you at the Solaria Report, I hope you let us know.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me on, Catherine. I really enjoyed this.
Have a great day. Bye.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.